now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental, LA to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Hello there, Dean Haglund. How are you?
Hey, Phil Lairness. Excellent. How are you?
I'm doing good. You know, we spoke a lot the last couple weeks, and it really feels like the last couple months about Halloween, because two months ago we did a horror film show, and so, you know, we got into the vibe of it, my friend.
Absolutely.
But the one thing that I neglected to mention from what I witnessed, not only at Halloween celebrations I attended, but from the Instagram and social media posts that I viewed and hearted, is...
Oh, your heart.
And this is the question. Is it possible that Barb from Stranger Things, the redhead who goes missing, is it possible she's the most popular character on all of television?
I think she's very easy to do. You know, it's sort of like Heath Ledger, the Joker from the latest Batman. You can just sort of smear some
Ledger?
Lipstick on
Heath,
you.
Did you just say Heath Ledger? Yeah. you were combining Jared Leto and Heath Ledger.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Because that Joker is all in one. But, you know,
Joker.
You can put it all. It's in the ease of how to do the makeup. You know, because when you're at the last minute, you sort of want something that you can just throw together, yet immediately recognizable. Hence why I often go as Langley from The X-Files. That's pretty easy.
Okay. Does anyone ever tell you that, you know, you almost look sort of like him?
No, never get that.
I just was overwhelmed. Like, this one party I went to, and yes, it was a Stranger Things themed party, I guess, but...
well, then, therefore, you are going to see...
But there's a photo... But, I mean, like, number 11, I thought, was the breakout character, right? The little girl, or Winona Ryder. Well, there was one of each of them. I think there were 8 Barbs. Men, women... children, people of different ethnicities, and all over this town, I've seen flyers up, you know, missing persons flyers for Barb. So,
you seem
disappointed by that.
Well, it seems that, you know, that may be one of those Netflix marketing scam things. You know, where
it's a scam. All right, you know, it's that very distrust. In
marketing
in
plans.
Our august institutions, such as Netflix, that has this country politically in such turmoil where people can't trust anything to the point that they'll elect a billionaire president. You see, I blame you. I blame you for just, you know...
carte blanching, just distrust.
Yeah, just so reactionarily... kicking any institution under the bus. All right.
Ah, damn it.
Oh,
I feel
my
guilty.
Goodness. What have you been up to since I last spoke to you, Dean?
Well, let's see. It is, once again, the improv tournament called the Cranston Cup. No relation to Bryan Cranston, but yet another improviser that used to live here in Sydney by the name, who had the last name Cranston. They name a trophy after him, and improvisers from all over Sydney and New South Wales get together and compete for this august ugly.
It would have been awesome if you had said, named for a great, you know, an important dignitary in Sydney history, Mr. Cup.
See what, that's
Let's make this the live event of the week while you think about what hilarious details you want to share with us.
Okay.
The Chilpack Hollywood live event of the week.
What hilarious details about this cup would you like to share with us, Dean Haggard?
Oh my gosh, so many. There's six teams competing, and a tradition here that you don't see in any other, well, maybe some other countries, but the teams sort of have themes and they wear costumes, wardrobes. So, for instance, the Rad Hatter, they're all in suspenders and hats.
Rad.
And then the white turtlenecks, well, they're three guys in white turtlenecks that perform. And, of course, we were named after there's three Canadians, expats living here that are on our team. And so we named ourselves after the beloved Canadian children's show, Mr. Dress-Up, Casey Finnegan, and Miss Biz. So some of the hilarious details that, we all sort of tried to dress as one of the characters from Mr. Dress-Up. I was, of course, looking like Casey with my blonde bob. And Casey, if you don't know, was just a plastic doll that didn't move its lips or eyes didn't move. It was just, it was a very sad puppet, actually.
Some might say that that's the role you were born to play.
See what you did there?
By the way, I want to point out to some people, if they've been hearing this sound.
What sound is that?
I don't know. Hopefully that picked up. But I'm just a little worried. You know, we were used to in the older days of your Chilpack Hollywood Hour hearing Mila and occasionally Akasha lapping up water, right, in the background.
Right.
And today that sound of snoring and moaning in one's sleep is not coming from you, dear listeners. We're not causing you pain while you sleep. No, that's my cat, who is curled
Fuzz
up and moaning with every statement, every utterance we make on this show.
Oh, I can't hear it over my headphones, but
yeah.
I hope she's dreaming impossible dreams.
Of better podcasts, no doubt.
No doubt.
So where are we at in this stage of the competition, then?
There's already some teams selected. There was a three-way tie, excitingly. Last night, so these three tied teams have to compete one more time this Sunday to determine who goes on to the big Cranston Cup at the historic 1907 Vaudeville House called the Enmore Theatre here in Sydney, which will be taking place on the 27th of November. And for all of those listening in Sydney, I, of course, will be in Los Angeles on that day. So please see my team compete its way to victory without me.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. So so your team is one of the three tied?
Yep.
Okay.
So we compete. I will be there to
first of all, it's very Canadian of you to say that it's really exciting that there's a three-way tie. Americans don't really dig ties too much. In fact, have the phrase here, it's like kissing your sister. Yes. A tie is like kissing your sister. Yes. And we don't mean, I don't mean your sister, Dean. I mean one's sister.
One sister. I get it. But the excitement
But apparently
here,
in Canada, where in the blistery cold, that is quite exciting.
Now, see, the idea is that every team is so skilled and perfectly matched that the score was tied and that now it comes down to just a mental game.
And really, the way that you do it is so much better because you get to sell three times as many foam number one hands. So that's that's really exciting.
Yeah.
I can't believe you're missing the finals.
I know. Isn't it a tragedy? I have no ability to influence when they actually book the theater a year in advance. And of course, they don't actually give me that information when I plan my travel itinerary back to Los Angeles. So those two things collided, and that's how it lays out.
Nor did you have in mind when you planned your itinerary to be here in Los Angeles this coming Sunday when I, for the second time on stage, MC an LABC home companion. This is taking place this Sunday night, the 13th, at the Friendship Auditorium. Anyone within the sound of my voice who enjoys music and dance and comedy and live theater. Really, do yourself a favor. This show is safe, people. Check it out, EncoreSundays.eventbrite.com. EncoreSundays.eventbrite.com.
Wow.
Dean, we've heard from a lot of people, which almost surprised me, about last week's show. Like, sometimes I know, okay, that was a good show. We nailed it.
Right.
Or I know we've done a topic that people are going to really respond
be curious about
to.
It.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But a couple times recently, the amount of reaction that we've had has surprised me. And we talked about how one of those episodes was the Western. I just did not realize either how much appetite there would be for that particular topic or how much people would enjoy what we had to say about it. But this last week, I've heard from so many people, and everybody picked something different that they loved about
wow.
last week's show, from our discussion about Documentary Now and how it's... I heard from one listener who said, you know, we didn't mention the two-part finale of Documentary Now, which might just be the greatest Hollywood parody. It's a parody of that documentary about Robert Evans, The Kid Stays in the Picture.
The Kid Stays in the Picture? They do a parody of that?
Yeah, even with the style of it, right? There's no live action. There's just photos. And it contains the single best parody of an Oscar ceremony ever by combining actual Oscar footage with footage that it's really tough to tell isn't from that Oscar ceremony.
Wow.
We've heard from Mark Bennett, who sent us a link to some video about brain chemistry in the wake of our discussion about why people derive so much comfort from seeing stories they already know. So I just wanted to say there wasn't a lot to follow up on, but I wanted to thank everybody who got in touch with us and remind people that the best way to get in touch with us is by writing us chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. No matter who you are, no matter how you are used to reaching out to us, that's the best way, because when putting this show together, that's the place where I know I can find what it is you want us to talk about. So please, write us there, won't you?
Won't you? It'll be fun.
Hey,
and we answer that stuff.
We didn't talk about this last weekend, but last weekend was a very exciting weekend of television for me personally, I must say, because it afforded not one, but two brand new opportunities to get to watch David Letterman on television.
What?
In his retirement. First of all, he was a presenter at the Mark Twain Prize, which was is awarded each year. This was the 19th year it was awarded there at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. And the recipient this year was Bill Murray.
Right.
And David Letterman was absolutely terrific. I mean, just looked great, you know, so much energy, just such a gifted, easy storyteller. And the other opportunity was he starred in the season two premiere episode of The Years of Living Dangerously. This is a Nat Geo show about climate change.
And he
went to India and brought a documentary crew and explored how, you know, this culture that's going to be the most populous country on Earth, more than 1.5 billion people already, how, you know, their grid is entirely based on burning of coal, and how it's such an old and unwieldy grid that it breaks down so often that everyone needs to have backup generators. And of course, all the backup generators are diesel burning. So so we go from bad to worse,
diesel, basically. Yeah, yeah.
And how much diesel is the backup generator grid generating? The backup generator grid is burning enough to power all of Australia.
Holy. That's just the backups.
That's
when the coals fail.
So you have not just these dirty sources of energy, but of course you've got waste. incredible waste. Right. So it was a look at, you know, what are they doing to try to go renewable while at the same time trying to get energy to hundreds of million, 300 million people, almost the population of the U.S., has never had electricity at all.
Wow.
So it was fascinating. And the thing that, so if anybody has a chance to check it out, please do watch it. I know it, that sounds like really depressing, but it's hopeful and it's entertaining, which is the reason you get David Letterman. And
yeah.
And he cares about this stuff and he's knowledgeable about this stuff. But it wasn't just, hey, it's fun seeing Dave, and it wasn't just that he's funny, and it wasn't just the kind of unique way among all other show hosts that he has of actually talking to ordinary people. And these are ordinary
right.
people in another country who don't know Dave as their TV buddy. So he's even more gifted, actually, because there isn't any sense of awe there.
Right. He's not riding on any sort of fame showbiz.
But he wrote his own narration, and he wrote it and recorded it while he was learning about these things. And, you know, his effortless and really approachable method of storytelling comes through in discussing these topics. And it's really quite refreshing. And it makes me wish, like somebody would say, maybe that's what we need to offer Dave, because he says that he is looking for what the thing will be in retirement. He knows he has things to express. He has no interest in ever doing a daily show again.
Right. It's a grind.
But maybe it's, you know, maybe it's 8 to 10 documentaries a year about topics that matter to him or that he's interested in learning about.
I would love that.
Yeah.
That would be phenomenal.
Wouldn't it be great?
How do you pitch that to him?
I don't know. And who do you pitch it to? I mean, but
right.
I bet maybe he still has Worldwide Pants. Maybe he still has his production. I imagine he does, right? Because they're doing other shows, and took all that Letterman footage off of YouTube immediately because they knew they could make money off of it. So, yeah, I mean, that'd be terrific.
I got my vote. I'm going to go look for that.
Speaking of great television, Dean Haglund, of which
yes.
we just started speaking, you know, Fargo season 2 was, I believe, my number one show of last
yes.
year, my top show. And it won't appear on my year-end top 10 of television shows this year because there has been no season 3.
Oh.
But season 3 is coming in spring of 2017, and of course I'm looking forward to it. The first season was great. The second season is even better. And
yeah.
now Jim Gaffigan has been
Come
cast.
On.
How perfect
no.
of casting is this for a Midwestern sheriff's deputy? Jim Gaffigan.
Oh my God. That's fantastic.
He will play Deputy Donnie Mashman, who works with Chief Gloria Burgle. The Leftovers' Carrie Coon plays Chief Gloria Burgle at the Eden Valley Police Department.
Fantastic.
Season 3 focuses on, from what I understand, it's set in 2010. So we jumped from the 2004 80s. Era to the 1979-1980 era. Now we're back to 2010. And it'll be interesting
right.
to see how they link this one. Because indeed, we find out at the end of season 2 that we've actually been watching all throughout it under different names, characters that would be critical to season 1. So it'll be
right.
interesting to see what happens on season 3. The basic premise is that it focuses on a pair of lookalike brothers, both played by Ewan McGregor.
Fantastic.
The older of the two, Emmett, is a good-looking, self-assured real estate magnate known as the Parking Lot King of Minnesota. His younger sibling, Ray, is a flabby parole officer who blames Emmett for his sorry state of affairs.
Wow, flabby? How are they going to do that?
So, maybe not as look-alike as they once were.
Yeah, I see.
So I'm excited about that. Now,
that sounds good.
A show that many of our listeners were excited about was the forthcoming, we think still forthcoming, Star Trek series that was going to launch CBS All Access, right? Star Trek Discovery. This is a show that was supposed to air, I believe, at the end of the year or start of next year on CBS before becoming available exclusively on CBS All Access. Big show, a lot of big names on the writing staff, $7 million budget per episode.
Gosh.
And as cynical as I was about this, as pessimistic as I was about this, people kept saying, oh, come on, Brian Fuller's the showrunner. So you have to be optimistic, Phil. And finally, I came over to their side, and I would say that I became guardedly optimistic.
Right.
Well,
your hopes were risen.
Yes. Now, I want to know from these people who thrust Brian Fuller in my face why I should be optimistic now that he has, in the parlance of Starfleet, been relieved of his command.
Oh, ouch.
And let's be honest here. It's the 50th anniversary of Star Trek, and it has been a... Well, there's been better years for this august franchise than its golden anniversary. Star Trek Beyond is taking a $70 million write-down.
Ouch.
To the point where we don't even know anymore if there will be a fourth, even though it was announced before Star Trek Beyond opened that there would be, almost like a marketing ploy that, hey, guys, make this one a hit, because the fourth one, we have Chris Hemsworth under contract playing Kirk's dad again, so you'll get to see Chris Pine and Chris Hemsworth, A Tale of Two Chrises. and while that would be fun, it, I guess, would have to be another time travel story, right, for him to be acting with his dad. But anyway, there has been an astonishing amount of silence about any kind of start dates or anything like that for the fourth one. So we will see.
Wow.
But Star Trek Discovery got pushed back. And that... you know, I didn't say I was pessimistic when it got pushed back at least 5 or 6 months.
It could mean they were embracing the quality.
Yes.
It could mean they're just trying to do it right.
But now, Brian Fuller, who, of course, was a showrunner on shows like Wonder Falls and Pushing Daisies, and who cut his teeth writing for Star Trek Deep Space Nine and Voyager, so he has Star Trek bona fides, he will not be the showrunner, as it turns out. They're saying he stepped down, but that seems a kind way of saying, hey, we're going to have to ask you to step down.
Right.
Because he's too busy with his other shows, a Starz drama, American Gods, and a reboot of Amazing Stories for NBC. So he's too busy to be a showrunner. And so he's been replaced by two people who worked with him on the writing staff of Pushing Daisies, Gretchen Berg and Aaron Herberts. And Harberts, sorry.
Harberts.
And they might be great choices. I don't want to say that they're not going to be, but as we talked about last week vis-a-vis The Fall, the Gillian Anderson show, and how that quality went down in season two, with a change in showrunners and then fell off the table altogether in season three, showrunners are important.
They're really important, and it's a really hard job. It is the combination of keeping the artistic and vision in line with all the writing staff, directors, and all the talent that comes aboard, and the running part, which is making it operate smoothly so that all departments can function to their best ability. In a timeline that's often very tight, sometimes 8 days of shooting, and under tight budgets that television has to, you know, they can't do movie budgets. You can't have the luxury of shooting one page a day. You got to crank out 4 to 10 pages a day if you hope to ever make your schedules. So,
which means even more preparation work. And, you know, detailed, focused prep work on the part of your showrunner, because you're having to condense so much more into a smaller period of time.
So true. And so much of this stuff, there's crises, there's casting conflicts, there's, you know, all sorts of things where the train can go off the the rail so easily that flying by the seat of your pants and having the ability to keep all that prep work and keep it all in your head, and I can't emphasize this enough, knowing from my days on the X-Files, staying positive. That's the thing. When it's 5 a.m. and you're on C unit and it's and you got your showrunner coming in dragging his feet and moping, it brings the entire production down. That guy's got to come in with the smile going, hey, man, everything's cool. This is going to be great. And that is in itself a Herculean duty.
Well, you know, and what you point out that's so unique to television as opposed to film, this showrunner is a producer responsible for keeping the trains running on time, the logistics, and the creative.
Yeah.
And that is not a combination that you see in film. You have a producer or a production manager and then a production staff underneath it, coordinators, assistant directors, what have you. And then you tend to have your creative producers. And yes, they are installed over that production manager or whatever, but it's not, you're not doing all the day-to-day minute detail planning that a showrunner is responsible for. So it's really the critical job in television that maybe was unsung for too long.
And that's why they're yeah. I mean, and you find ones that have track records. So because it's a muscle that you have to build. And if you take your time off for too long, you can lose that muscle really quickly because it's one of the hardest gigs. And so it's bench pressing the 300 kilos that the moment you stop, you have muscle atrophy almost the next day. So again, you got to find somebody who's been doing it and who's immediately off a series to go into that next series. And that's why you often see it's the same showrunners going from show to show to show.
So anyway, there was apparently strain between Brian Fuller and CBS, first because they had to push it back to May, and apparently they are unwilling to delay it again. And after all, you want to launch this 50th anniversary program while it still is the 50th anniversary. As Kirk says in Star Trek The Motion Picture, you know, we want to reach V'ger while it still is out there.
Wow, that is a great parallel reference. Fantastic.
One of my favorite shows, as you know, year in, year out, is Veep. I think it's one of yours as well.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a show that absolutely survived this year a change in showrunner after Armando Iannucci left to be able to spend more time with his family back in London. And
yep.
So then the show was able to move from the East Coast to Los Angeles so that the cast could spend more time with their families.
Right.
And it survived. And it was a terrific, season. So obviously, yeah. When I say that I get the feeling this Star Trek Discovery is going to be a mess, it doesn't have to be that way. But it sure is a lot easier if you're handing over showrunner duties to have already had a template that's been up and running for quite a while.
Well, that's also another key point. So you have tone. You have all your actors already in place on how to have their characters interact and be alive in the show. And that's the thing. Veep's tone was very unique at the time, but now as season goes on, you sort of like, oh, you get it. And I'm sure it was easy and not easy at the same time to find a showrunner who could emulate that tone.
I think it's interesting that, of course, you know, the original Star Trek only running for three seasons, as opposed to Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, and Voyager all running seven, and yet all the offshoots of that original series took maybe into their second season before they really found themselves and found their footing, whereas mm-hmm. the original series kind of found it with the arrival of Gene Kuhn as showrunner sometime during season one. So again, there's the important figure of the right showrunner really helping
yep.
you find it quickly. So anyway, we will see. Speaking of Veep, I got an email from our friend and a frequent contributor to your Chill Pack
yeah.
Hollywood Hour, Yoshi Kato, who
oh, yeah.
Wondered if I had ever seen the HBO American-based remake directed by Christopher Guest. It was a pilot of Armando Iannucci's great BBC series, The Thick of It.
What?
In 2007, Christopher Guest directed for HBO a pilot for a proposed series that would Americanize The Thick of It. As you know, we both championed the movie In the Loop, which was a big screen adaptation of The Thick of It, followed some of the same characters, and then virtually the whole cast played new characters, but it did follow like Peter Capaldi's character and things like this. Anyway, I did not see the I never saw the pilot of The Thick of It for HBO. I don't know how anyone would, though it might be one of those things that's available online.
That would be neat.
But as I remember, what was kind of shocking about it was not that it didn't get picked up, but that one of the reasons that it didn't get picked up was that Armando Iannucci, one of the producers of it, obviously, and a co-creator of it, hated it so much. And he really didn't want HBO to air it.
Wow.
And I'll tell you why he hated it so much in a moment. But from those conversations about why he hated it and what he really wanted it to be, from those conversations spring the origins of Veep for HBO.
Ah.
And, of course, Christopher Guest, for his part, is given the chance to then develop and air one season of The Family Tree.
Right. That came from this as well.
Yeah, probably because they owed him. But what's stunning about it, I mean, what really shocked me, I guess it shouldn't have, given what we were talking about with Mascots. Did you check out Mascots yet on Netflix?
I did, yes. I watched it last
week. Okay, and do you remember what I was saying about how, you know, I just feel from a directorial standpoint, there's energy lacking. There's a little bit of laziness.
Yeah.
That belies some great character work that's being done.
True.
And especially by, like I said, Tom Bennett, the young man who plays the British mascot.
Yeah,
So, but anyway, 10 years ago, 9 years ago, Christopher Guest directs The Thick of It, which is an American version of a BBC series based on improvisation. And Christopher Guest does not allow any of the actors to improvise.
Now, that's weird. Now, is that because Richard Day and Mitchell Hurwitz, who did Arrested Development, are the writers of this thing? And so you're trying to stay true to these Emmy Award-winning writing team and that you don't want to screw that up? I wonder if that's...
Are we saying that there wasn't improvisation going on Arrested Development?
I'm saying that might be the case, because I was rewatching actually second season just showed up on my stream, and I'm like, now that seems so loose, and yet the scripting has to be so tight you can't go off on improvisational tangents because all of those things have to be so linked together.
Well,
so
that is interesting. That's interesting. Yeah. So maybe you're onto something here, because it always seemed odd to me that. You know, first of all, well, why are you then adapting Armando Iannucci's show? I understand you're a big fan, but everything you loved about it was born out of and discovered through improvisation. So why are you adapting it then? And why Christopher Guest? Are you trying to get a director who can give it the feel as if it was improvised when in fact it's totally scripted? I mean, that seems odd. And it seems odd that Christopher Guest wouldn't have thought then to bring his own approach to it, but again, maybe he's a man that by 2007, you know what, I don't have it in me to go to battle over this.
Right.
Stuff.
Yeah, picking his battles.
And
probably there was.
And I could totally understand that. He seems like just quite the gentleman, Christopher Guest.
Mm-hmm.
So I have no problem with him not doing a battle in the workplace, though that lack of fire to do battle. Then brings me back to maybe he shouldn't have directed Mascots. Maybe someone else should have instead.
that would have fought for different choices and sort of thing.
Yeah, because, I mean, you know better than I, but, I mean, going into the editing room must be quite the Herculean task on a Christopher Guest movie. And I just feel like sometimes they took just the path of least resistance editorially.
Well, the path of what's the story, just the straight-ahead story of character setup, dilemma, resolution. And so in so doing, it seemed that each one of those characters sort of lived in isolation. Like you took any one of those mascots, and you could have shot that in a week, their story, and then you just intercut it all throughout, leading up to the competition. So that also that compartmentalization leads also to a fragmentation of the drive of a through line for the movie itself. You know what I mean? That you're just involved with each actor's character, and then you assemble it, and it's just an assembly of characters as opposed to a movie.
Did you enjoy, though, as I said that you would, the closing performances? Like, my biggest my biggest fear was that that wasn't going to work because it's such a phony event, but the event felt real.
It did. And it felt, and it was actually kind of exciting who was going to win. And, you know, the NHL on rollerblades mascot was hilarious. There was so many elements that were surprising and fun.
And one of the things is Ed Begley as the judge, Ed Begley Jr. as the judge, his reactions to what he's seeing feel so real and authentic and specific that, again, I believe what I'm seeing.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So I think that's a real key in a lot of improv, is that you keep it believable and you have honest reactions. And I think that you saw a lot throughout a lot of the performances. I think that was reiterated probably by Christopher Guest as one of his main directorial points, is that, you know, as wacky as all this seems, keep it believable and keep your actions as truthful as possible.
I also thought that the story about the two half-sisters, Parker Posey, and especially the actress, and I'm forgetting her name, who plays her half-sister, I had not seen that relationship before. I had not seen that story, and that actually felt real, and I just kind of wish almost like I'd seen a whole movie about those characters.
Yeah, kind of. In fact, that's sort of how I felt about the whole thing. It's like, you know, I would have just liked to focus on any one of those groups.
Interesting.
For a longer time.
Except maybe the Fred Willard character, although, God help me, when he meets the worm, right, the little person who plays the worm,
oh my God,
picks that guy's brain, that is phenomenal.
That's a funny scene.
Yeah,
that's what he's best at, is like, you know, going into awkward situations and just sort of smoothing it over with the, you know, idiocracy and confidence at the same time.
So we've spent a lot of time here talking about television. We are in the beginning of the season of self-congratulation. I want to talk about a couple of movies and things that have come out cinematically. But before we let go too far of Star Trek and Chris Pine, I would like to say, and I don't think I've ever asked you about this book, but Chris Pine has joined the cast of what I believe should be a hugely anticipated project, and that is the big screen version of A Wrinkle in Time.
Oh.
Now, were you a fan of A Wrinkle in Time when you were a kid?
No, I wasn't, actually. I don't know why that passed me by. I think I was already into my comic book art phase, so somehow that one missed it. But
for people who don't know, I guess, I'll just briefly say that The Wrinkle in Time, it's a science, I guess science fantasy is what we would call it. It's not science fiction, but science fantasy novel, written by American writer Madeline L'Engle. First published in 1963, it revolves around a young girl whose father, a government scientist, has gone missing after working on a mysterious project called a Tesseract. And, of course, this is the big device that everyone's looking for in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, is a Tesseract.
That's right, yeah.
The book won a Newbery Medal, a Sequoia Book Award, Lewis Carroll Shelf Award, blah, 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 blah. a lot of awards. And, you know, right. as a writer, you're really just in it for the awards. it's first in a series of books that Lengel wrote about the Murray and O'Keefe families. It was my favorite book as a child. I read this again and again. I think maybe third, fourth grade, right around there. Maybe it was a little earlier. But, you know, for several years in there, I would read it every summer. And again, I should point out, when I was a kid, I had seen movies, but I really didn't dig movies. I really loved books, and especially science fiction books. And maybe right. it's because I just didn't see movies that were as cool as what I was imagining in my mind when I was reading these books, right?
Exactly. That's always the thing, particularly with science fiction, is that you envision it so much more miraculously than a lot of the digital effects.
Whereas the exception being the Star Trek television series, which did have so much imagination, and not only that, but depicted a future that, as a kid who was often a little bit felt a little bit like an outcast or was frightened of certain things, this was an imaginative vision of the future that was, hey, this is a fight for it. This is a future we're yes. fighting for. So that captured my imagination. But Wrinkle in Time, I've always been kind of surprised that it's never been brought to the big screen before. And in fact, it has. It was adapted at various points into a graphic novel, a play, and opera, and a Canadian feature film.
What?
When asked if that film met her expectations, I think it was 1992, when asked if that film met her expectations, author Madeline Lengel said, "Yes, I expected it to be bad, and it is."
That's diplomatic.
So Chris Pine has joined the cast as Mr. Murray, as the government scientist and the father, the missing father of the primary character. And it's being directed by Ava DuVernay, who last mm-hmm. directed Selma.
Right.
And,
big deal.
She is bringing to bear on this project a pretty amazing cast. You've got Oprah Winfrey as Mrs. Witch, Reese Witherspoon as Mrs. What's-It, Mindy Kaling as Mrs. Who, Gugu Mbatha-Raw, who is so good as the title character in Belle, and recently as Will Smith's character's wife, Bennett Amalu's wife in the movie Concussion, and Zach Galifianakis as the Happy Medium. So I think this should be a highly anticipated project.
Yeah, and I see Jennifer Lee's screenplay is who wrote Frozen and other massive hits will be doing the adaptation. So that might be something.
Now, because you and I don't enjoy dealing strictly in the positive, we always take time each year, and really since we're under the gun to create 10 top 10 shows to commemorate wow. our 10th anniversary.
Right.
We've done two, is that right? Westerns and...
Horror.
And horror. So maybe yeah. this year we do need to make sure to do a whole episode not only about the top 10, but the worst 10, because that gets rid of another one we need. And I am pleased to say that I have a glorious possibility for...
worst?
I've had others. I've had others for worst. I mean, I had Batman v Superman and I you know, some others. But boy, as bad as I thought, if you remember our summer preview, as bad as I thought X-Men Apocalypse was going to be,
yeah,
it is so much worse in such a different way.
What?
do you remember I thought, and do you remember the trailers or whatever, my fear was how pompous and serious this movie would take itself?
Yes, it was over...
I thought it was almost fetishistic, right?
Yeah.
This movie, and no one involved in the making of it, gives a fuck.
Is that true?
I think with the exception of, I guess, Michael Fassbender and maybe James McAvoy, God bless him, who... is a talented actor and has done good stuff, and I'm beginning to realize he wouldn't know if a script works, you know, anyway. It is the kind of tongue-in-cheek that comes from most of your brain being dedicated to thinking about how quickly you can deposit the check.
Oh, no. You're kidding.
It is. There is literally no story and no reason to tell it. I mean, it's just like, hey, I have an idea of how we can keep this cash cow going. Great. We don't need to hear it. You know? Here's, show us some costume drawings. Yeah. Oh my God. And it'll be a great way to introduce new people as beloved characters so we can just keep it going. And, even if each movie makes less and less money, the more we put in people that are unknowns to play these beloved characters, we won't have to pay them anything, so we can keep squeezing money out of it.
Right. And then that idea, if any one of them hits, if any spaghetti sticks against the wall, we can use that as a platform for the next whatever and which way we're going with this.
Now, I also saw a movie that had come highly recommended to me from some people in the business. It's from this year, and I would highly recommend it for you, especially knowing that Euro Dreams of Sushi was your number one 1 year. And this,
yes.
This both fits the bill of being a really a foodie lover's delight, this documentary.
Uh-huh.
And although I wouldn't put myself in that category, I wrote down the name of every restaurant discussed in this, so that I might be able to avail myself of their offerings. But it also is such a love letter to the Los Angeles that I think very few people, even people who live here, know. And the name of the movie is City of Gold. And it's a documentary about food critic, originally music critic, turned food critic, Jonathan Gold.
Jonathan Gold, the Pulitzer Prize winning.
First food critic ever to win a Pulitzer Prize. And I love how the only bad review you can find of this movie is from RogerEbert.com. Which I think both offends me and delights me that the only negative review would come from an outlet named for the first film critic to win a Pulitzer.
How ironic.
And in the review, it even derides the idea that food journalism can rise to the level of journalism worthy of a prize. And by the way, your name for Roger, never mind. And it's a love letter to the importance of print criticism, of written criticism, especially in an era of aggregate sites and Yelp where everybody can share their opinion. But what is the role of a critic? And truly, it's a beautiful movie. Again, if you love Los Angeles in particular, but if you love any urban environment, it's a beautiful movie. Because both of the way that he has helped shape it by championing certain kinds of cuisines that mm-hmm. were never reviewed before, and restaurants that would never have been reviewed before.
Right.
So anyway,
his hole in the walls. Like his one of my favorite articles was his goal was to go down Pico and go to every restaurant. Like some that you never you
from
would drive
downtown
by
all the way to the beach. For people who don't know, that's what? How many miles? 11 miles?
That'd be 11 miles of restaurants. Yeah.
And
so I don't know if he ever completed that task.
He did. He spent 1 year doing it. And the year I ate on Pico was the name of an essay that he wrote about it. He would, on average, apparently he goes to a restaurant 17 times before he reviews it.
Wow.
Think about that.
I didn't know that.
And
good Lord.
And that would include negative reviews.
I know. That's what I'm thinking. You go to this place you hate. Well, I got to check it out 16 more times.
Because he wants to put it into a context to try to understand it, to try to review it on its terms and the cultural terms. Because you're talking about cuisines, especially in Los Angeles, from so many different parts of the world. So what does this food mean to them? And why did it come about in this way? And why is it being preserved? And why, you know, and
in this age of celebrity chefs, and I see it here in Sydney a lot, is a guy will fly in, open a lavish opening night. Maybe that food quality stays there for a month or so. But then all of those chefs and sous chefs follow the celebrity chef out the door as he goes and starts another thing. And then you're left with just sort of third string or guys you just hired off of Craigslist. And the quality drops off almost within 30 days of its opening. And so you've heard great things about this place, but then you go back a year, like not even a month later, and it's already falling behind in terms of the necessity of keeping that quality going night after night, 6 days a week. And so I could see why you would go 17 times before you review it.
So City of Gold, Dean, you need to check that out.
I'm going to find it.
Apropos of, I guess, nothing but a great segue to a show we're about to record for future listening enjoyment, I watched the comedy classic from 1949 last night, directed by George Cukor, Adam's Rib.
Classic vehicle
for Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn. But, you know, in addition to Katharine Hepburn, this was written by Ruth Gordon and her husband, Garson Kanin. And, of course, Ruth Gordon would go on to great fame as an actress long after her writing career when she starred in Rosemary's Baby and Harold and Maude, right?
Right.
And so you've got this strong, really unique woman writing it, strong, unique woman starring in it. But you also, in supporting roles, have both Judy Holliday, the year before she won the Oscar for Born Yesterday, and Gene Hagen, Judy Holliday's understudy in Born Yesterday on Broadway.
Wow,
and,
I didn't know that.
And so I thought that was interesting, and apropos of the fact that we're about to record our top 10 all-time favorite musicals, Holliday and Hagen remain inextricably linked because of a little movie called Singing in the Rain, which starred, among others, Gene Hagen as a silent era movie star whose voice is so shrill it can't translate to the sound era. And that part was supposed to be played by Judy Holliday.
I did not know that.
But because she had just won the Oscar for Born Yesterday, her price went up way too much and she was unavailable. So Gene Hagen goes in to audition for it. And what does she do in the audition? Her Judy Holliday imitation. And she books the part. And she, you know, gets a nomination for it. Anyway,
fantastic.
That'll be a fun show for us to do top 10 all-time favorite musicals. I think that show will become available.
Great.
We have just a couple minutes here, and you know, this is Monday here in the States when this show becomes available, and so a day from now is a little election here in the United States.
Tell me more about this.
Which,
I haven't heard a thing.
Will probably be decided a year from now.
Yes,
after both people are impeached somehow, even though neither of them win. I don't know what the hell is going on. But I wanted to say that as this tightens, because this race has been tightening dramatically and there's been so much made over the FBI's seemingly politicizing of their duty. And but, you know, year after year at every election time, the media reports that the polls are getting closer. Maybe the polls are getting closer, but I've always thought it was interesting that every year the polls are getting closer and nearer to the election, almost as if there's a deal made to make sure people really turn out to vote and that people tune in to watch the results.
If the polls are so far apart, you go, we don't have to vote.
Exactly.
And then... so you have to say it's a tight race and get out there.
So maybe that's just a little bit of my own conspiracy theory, but I have noticed historically that things always seem to tighten up as you approach the election. What amused me, I guess is the right word, is that a whole bunch of famous people have claimed that they will leave the country if Trump wins. And this happens all the time. Every election, people say, I'm going to leave the country.
Election.
And the thing is that these famous people saying it, that's exactly what Trump supporters want. I mean, you're encouraging a bigger turnout for Trump. And I understand. I mean, hell, Dean Hagland is threatening never to come back.
That's right. I'm enjoying it here so much that potentially, I don't know. I'll wait 4 years maybe here. Ride it out.
But I would say this time, with this unique presidential candidate, I would encourage as many famous people as possible, as many leaders of business and entertainment. I want there to be a huge brain drain north to Canada, so that Trump has to abandon building the wall to Mexico and will be forced to build it on the Canadian border, where it always should have been, to keep Americans in. That's what I would like to
That's
see.
Pretty funny.
I guess I have some... I guess my final thought about this is, I've been aware that people on both sides have been saying that World War III is a fait accompli if the other person gets elected.
I know, right? Both of them are saying that.
Yeah, and...
That's always bad. That just says World War III, no matter what, technically.
I'm reminded that when you and I first started this show, and George W. Bush was the president, and I, of course, had spent a few years making a movie called Karl Rove, I Love You, and I would see these protests where people were comparing George W. Bush to Hitler all the time, right?
All the time.
And then,
it's your classic go-to.
And then you see Obama being compared to Hitler. And
not sure how.
You know, this whole... And what we're seeing, I think, as a lot of Democrats are, you know, going, oh my God, look at these things that Trump has done. How are those not, to most people, so much worse than an email scandal? And I can't help feeling what you and I talked about, like, at the beginning of this show. When you start throwing out comparisons to Hitler, to everyone you disagree with, it rapidly becomes Boy Who Cried Wolf.
Yeah, right? If everybody's Hitler, then no one's Hitler.
Yeah, and if every election is the most important of a generation, or the most important of our era, that yes, ordinarily we would never say lesser of two evils, except this time. And if you say that every single time, well, lo and behold, you do create the environment in which someone like Donald Trump can walk through the door.
Right.
Because so many pillars that have been in place of decorum and conversation and debate and exchange of ideas have just been knocked down. And as the publisher of The Atlantic said on Bill Maher the other night, Donald Trump didn't knock any of these pillars down. He's just taken advantage of them all being down.
Exactly. Yeah, he's the one that walks through the door, as you say.
The good news, I decided I'd leave our listeners with Akasha. Akasha's here. Akasha's having bad nightmares. She's having nuclear nightmares.
She's saying hello to the cat in the neighborhood. Thank you, Akasha.
You know, I was a kid who had nuclear nightmares. I mean, I was really terrified by nuclear proliferation. And there was a song that I would listen to that would enable me to laugh about it. And so I thought I would share that song at the end of the show from the great Tom Lehrer, because as you pointed out, Dean, apparently whichever side wins, World War III is a fait accompli. So we might as well just embrace joyfully what wants to come forward. And so I'll leave this uplifting survival hymn as the close of today's show. And of course, you can find every episode of your Chillpack Hollywood Hour at chillpackhollywood.com, C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K, Hollywood.com. You can like us on Facebook.
Please like us.
We're at facebook.com/chillpackhollywood.
Mm-hmm. You can email us at chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com, like so many people do.
Follow us on Twitter.
Follow us on and Instagram.
We're at Dean and Phil.
Right. Put the word and in, and realize all the hashtags that Phil works overtime to put in on the Instagram.
Hashtag we give good hashtag. Until next week, I'm Phil Lernis.
I'm Dean Aglin. See you then.
Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas.
When you attend a funeral, it is sad to think that sooner or later those you love will do the same for you. And you may have thought it tragic, not to mention other adjectives, to think of all the weeping they will do. But don't you worry, no more ashes, no more sackcloth, and an armband made of black cloth will someday nevermore adorn a sleeve. For if the bomb that drops on you gets your friends and neighbors too, there'll be nobody left behind to grieve, and we will all go together when we go. Oh, what a comforting fact that is to know. Universal bereavement, an inspiring achievement. Yes, we all will go together when we go. We will all go together when we go. All suffused with an incandescent glow. No one will have the endurance to collect on his insurance. Lloyd's of London will be loaded when they go. Oh, we will all fry together when we fry. We'll be French fried potatoes by and by. There will be no more misery when the world is our rotisserie. Yes, we all will fry together when we fry. Down by the old maelstrom, there'll be a storm before the calm, and we will all bake together when we bake. There'll be nobody present at the wake, with complete participation in that grand incineration, nearly 3 billion hunks of well-done steak. Oh, we will all char together when we char, and let there be no moaning of the bar. Just sing out a tedium when you see that ICBM, and the party will be come as you are. Together when we burn, there'll be no need to stand and wait your turn. When it's time for the fallout and St. Peter calls us all out, we'll just drop our agendas and adjourn. You will all go directly to your respective Valhallas. Go directly, do not pass, go, do not collect $200. Every Hottentot and every Eskimo. When the air becomes Uranus, we will all go simultaneous. Yes, we all will go together when we all go together. Yes, we all will go together when we go.
Belated spoiler alert.